Guess I'm a bit of a sort of a housing expert, but I'll try not to say too much tonight because I think you want a very potted history and one that sort of can just fill in some of the gaps, perhaps, as Mike said, in the context of what's happening here in Waterloo now. And I'm sure we're going to have a really interesting discussion provoked by what I say and what Julie says. So maybe if I could just have the first slide. I guess academics and policymakers start with some sort of definition. What is public housing? Many of you know in many ways what public housing is, and it has a personal meaning to you. But in the sort of literature, if we think about what is public housing, we think of it as housing that the government owns and government manages. And usually the government finances it as well and oversees the development of it. So that distinguishes it from private housing, which is developed, managed and owned by private individuals or private companies. And it also distinguishes it from government housing that might be managed by another party, like a community housing organisation. The other thing about it is the government doesn't allocate it according to market rules, who can pay the most. It allocates it according to some other rules, which it from time to time decrees and changes, what we call policy. And usually the rules are something about need, however that might be defined, and that's a very loaded, socially constructed term. But government makes rules about who needs public housing and then allocates it according to that need. And often because need is ordered by capacity to pay or income or having some disadvantage, the government usually makes the rent affordable as well. So there's a subsidy implicit in public housing. You don't pay a market rent, you pay another rent calculated to actually take account of the capacity of the tenant or the resident to pay. So they're the things that sort of make it up. It's non-market, it's allocated according to some rules set by government, not by who can compete in a marketplace, and it attempts to provide an affordable rent through some form of subsidy or offsetting of a market rent. Lots of people use the term social housing. Where's that come from and what's the difference between public housing and social housing? There's no single view of this. Different countries, and I'll say a little bit about other countries as I go through the talk, but different countries use the terms differently, as you'd expect. In Australia, we used to never talk about social housing. We talked about public housing, and the sort of introduction of social housing, or more precisely, social rental housing, because you can think of any housing that government subsidises as social, having some sort of underlying social objective and being, therefore, government subsidising it to meet that objective. It sort of came in to bring in to the fact that we were diversifying away from only government-managed and owned housing to other forms of social housing, and in particular in the local context community housing, but also Indigenous housing, housing co-ops, all trying to meet the same needs, all with some of the same principles, allocated by need, subsidised, but not actually owned and controlled by government. There's another party, a third party involved. So if you like, social housing is a bit of a broader term, a more inclusive term, to allow for those different models. And public housing is just one form of social housing. So that's my attempt to sort of put a framework around what we mean by public housing. And we may want to discuss that, or has retracted its role in building public housing. But basically today, the government's hardly building anything. We don't even know how much they're demolishing. But in terms of what they're building, it's probably about 1% of the new housing that's built. So the system is stagnant, it's not growing. So most of what is there because it was built in the past and has been retained, not because they're adding to it today. So that's a little bit of a potted overview of what's public housing. We'll go on to the next slide if I can. There would be a project here or there. So I think every state in Australia had one project where the government funded the building of some public housing, and it became like a showcase or a demonstration. And the well-known one in Sydney, of course, is Daisy Gardens, 1900 1912 when they first started to build it. I don't think they finished it till 1924. There's probably people here who know about other projects of that time around Sydney, but they were just dotted. And the council built some housing, and there was sort of, from time to time, an initiative, which was to sort of say, government can show the way, not only in terms of meeting needs, but also in terms of demonstrating different principles of housing design and housing provision. So Dacey Gardens was celebrated as a garden suburb that would provide healthy housing for working families. And if you look at today, I mean, it's very large provision of garden and based very much on planning principles coming out of England about how to design healthy cities and healthy suburbs. The project level sort of response, the early kind of flowering of the idea that government could and should provide housing, was sort of ramped up by the establishment of housing commissions. And every state basically got one of these sometime between 1939 and 1947. So South Australia went first, was the South Australian Housing Trust, and that became a bit of an exemplar for the other states, that we'll actually establish an organisation with the skills to develop and maintain housing. And in New South Wales, our turn was in 1942, the Housing Commission was established, and went on being the Public Housing Authority till 1985, as some of you would well remember. And most of the media still talks about the Housing Commission today, it's such an embedded institution. And it was set up to be a developer of housing. That's really what its strength was. These days it hardly develops anything, as I said, or its successor organisations hardly develop anything. What they do is manage tenancies and access to housing. But the Housing Commission had a big day labour force, it had all the professions, the architects, the surveyors, etc. And what it did, in the days when private developers weren't so big or so extensive, is it built large amounts of housing. So we got these housing commissions, there would be this alternative system of public housing. So it wasn't means tested. The idea was it was for working people who chose not to buy or couldn't buy, and for return servicemen. But at that time, we had a much, much smaller cohort of older people and people with special needs and so on, and they weren't considered, in any case, the clients for public housing. So the next slide. So by the time we ended up in a Commonwealth State Housing Agreement, and I just want to give you a bit of an impression of the scale of this, because it was very significant and it's a legacy issue today. So in 10 years, 96,000 homes were built. So that's 10,000 a year for 10 years. And remember I said today we're hardly building any, and we were a much, much smaller country then. And that was against a shortage of 300,000. So it was making a real difference. About a third of that shortage was overcome in 10 years. Mm. And of all the new building that was going on, about 14% of it was the housing commissions. So if you looked at who was applying for the development and who was doing the building, it was the public authority, about 14%. So that was a massive stimulus in economic terms, as well as an incredibly important provision for anyone who tried to access it. And basically it was allocated on a wait turn basis. So I think, I'm sure there were waiting lists then, I'm sure there was many more people clamouring to get into the housing that was being built, but there was regular new supply coming through, the waiting list turned over, and a variety of people were getting housed. And they paid a rent that was commensurate with the cost of providing that housing.
Good.
Okay. They didn't get a subsidy as such. There was provision for subsidies for those who were really down and out, like you may be a widow or somebody who'd fallen on hard times, was ill, whatever. But generally, they just paid a cost rent. And that was the model. And we should be helping people to own their own homes. There's lots of quotes from that time. I didn't actually dig them out. But things like, it's an antidote to all the isms of our time, which meant this was the period of the threat of communism and the referendum about communism. So antidote to the isms. There were also more sinister interpretations about, if a man owns his own home, then he'll be a good worker and he'll be a steady employee because he'll be tied down. Yeah.
So pre-56, was it a bipartisan political position?
Often Britain's talked about in terms of right to buy, but this actually preceded that, and it was massive. And so instead of using the money to build housing and give tenants secure rental, what they did was they discounted the housing that they built so that tenants could afford it. They gave them so they discounted the price and gave them concessional loans. They actually built housing that they on-sold directly to applicants who'd never been tenants. So like a market role, really, for a first home buyer. And they provided finance where the banks or the building societies didn't, for people who were too risky to lend to. They actually provided vendor finance. They also had rent-to-buy schemes. They went the whole hog, everything they could do. They were still building the housing, but wherever they could, it was sort of then the person living in it or the person seeking to live in it was assisted to buy it. So a lot of the problems we've got today actually stem from right here. Because if you think that with public money and public endeavour, 840,000 dwellings were built between 1945 and 1972 when this regime ended, only 120,000 of them remained in 1981. So, you know, we had built a capacity that would have gone on and provided through turnover and through reinvestment and through redevelopment, public housing for a very long time at a scale that might have been possible to manage what ends up emerging as very significant needs. But by the time in 1980 we realised the importance of that, we only had 120,000 dwellings left. And the people who'd bought their own homes had been very successful for them, but that housing and the access to that housing was then all market driven. And so it could no longer be, if you like, targeted. And I mean, you know, that's the story of the Green Valleys and all of the Toongabbies and the other parts of Sydney that look like public housing, but where it's all salt and peppered. And that's because most of it was unsold. And of course, there was another legacy, which was that what didn't sell was super lots, where the housing isn't separately serviced, and flats. A lot of the flats were built later when the technology allowed it and the housing commissions led the way, particularly in Victoria. If you've been to Melbourne, there's 44 high-rise towers that are public housing in inner Melbourne. It's about 40% of their whole supply, and they own their own concrete factory to build those towers. So they just kept churning out the same product over and over again. So originality on who can be housed, how long you can be housed. You've got the idea of fixed-term tenancies, you've got the idea of, you know, people having to move on, people only being allowed to stay for the duration of their need, those sort of devices, all of which are about how do we get a fit between this limited capacity and need. And, of course, one thing that is quite external to this thinking is what actually happened in society to change needs, and that's very important too, and many of you have lived through this. So we had the emergence of single parents, single income families, in large numbers, and those people found that neither private renting nor home ownership was viable in many cases. So they were a new group needing public housing, which had never been thought about. We had deinstitutionalisation. You want me to hurry up? Yeah. We had deinstitutionalisation, which meant tenants needed support to live independently. That was not accompanied by any provision of housing. So by default, those people looked, in many cases, to public housing. We had more unemployment because we had tougher economic times. Mm-hmm. And we also, for the first time, said, well, we should be housing single people because public housing only housed older single people, not others. So there was this big increase in demand, this constricted supply, and hence the problems. And in 1996, as the sort of last straw in my view for the model, the Commonwealth took off all its requirements for their money to be used for new supply. It was a kind of tacit acknowledgement that the system wasn't viable and that the money was needed to make up the difference between the rents and the costs. But it basically meant that nobody was driving new supply, and new supply basically ceased And this graph is really telling. So what this graph is, the graph goes up. It doesn't go up at the rate of population. It's always being kind of pulled back, restricted in some way, but it goes up. But the poor old social housing graph goes down. So I'll move on quickly to finish this up. I just wanted to say, a lot of people sometimes say, oh, well, how much public social housing or public housing should we have? What's the right size for public housing? And have we got the same problems everywhere? Well, it's very different around the world, so we have to acknowledge that. It's played a very different role in the welfare system. So much of Western and Northern Europe, it's been absolutely critical to give, as part of an economic strategy, to give people secure housing to enable them to participate in society and to work. And so most of the Northern and Western European systems have around 20%. The Netherlands has 30-something percent. And when you hear that they're retracting from those very high bases. So the Netherlands used to have 40%, it's now 30%. Well, 30% is a very different capacity to meet a diversity of needs and to be viable than 5% or 4%. And that's our problem. In Eastern Europe, there was 100% public housing. Government provided it. And after the end of communism, it was all privatised. They sort of did what we did in the 50s. So the people who were living in the housing now own it. But whether they can afford to maintain it and who will provide for future generations is left open in those countries. In Singapore and Hong Kong, it's completely inadequate for present purposes. As I said, that's happened elsewhere too, with austerity, with changing view of the role of government, the idea of small government, the idea that markets do best, but not so much damage, perhaps. The strategies now are pretty feeble. We're talking about transfers of management to community housing organisations, but it's not actually giving them the opportunity to control the housing and develop new ways of doing things. It's contractual management. It's driven by trying to get capture funding that the Commonwealth provides to private but not public tenants. It's not visionary. It may lead to something else, but it's a limited model. The redevelopment of Waterloo is all about capturing the value in the land here to enable the housing to be brought up to standard, but there won't be more housing. And if we don't fight hard, there'll be less. And the extra value that's created is all going into profit and into luxury housing. So there's a lack of equity in that model. The more and more you make public housing an emergency response or a special needs response, the more and more you segregate the people in it from what is a normalised model. And the other policy strategy is, oh, well, the private rental market will respond. Let's put more money into the private rental market. And I could spend quite a while telling you why I think that model won't work. So I don't want to end on a negative note, and I'm sure Julie will pick up on where are we going here, but I just thought I'd put up a few. I feel like I should give you some vision about how it could be different. And I mean, I think the first thing is that governments and communities more broadly have to re-embrace the idea that everybody having affordable, secure housing is critical economically and socially to the health and well-being of a society, you know. And so we really need, and we're seeing that now in the debate, we really need to see housing up the political barometer as a right and as a right for everybody, and that governments have to lead in that because markets have actually failed. We clearly need to revive the building. We've got to somehow bridge that gap on that other slide. I'm suggesting nationally at least 10,000 a year. I mean, if we were more ambitious, 20,000 a year. And we could do that. It's about 15% of the effort that's going on every year out there in the market. And if that was government funded, that would make the difference not only to your access and supply, but also it would start to influence the cost structures in the market and the way the market behaves. And Western Australia's shown that. Where they got involved, they could start to change thinking about the market and how to make lower cost housing and innovation and bring technology to that market, which individual providers themselves find difficult to do, but government can lead on. The redevelopment could be not-for-profit. And in the UK, The housing associations, the equivalent of our community housing providers, have been front and centre in doing redevelopment. That means that the profits from the development and the selling of the better quality of the higher priced housing goes back into the purpose of the organisation, which is to produce more low cost housing. So you're recycling the profits in a social system rather than in a market system. And the thing can take equity out when they leave, so it's a kind of a part ownership model, but the land, which is where the value is locked in for the community's long-term benefit. And if we are relying on the private rental market, and I'm sure Julie will say more about this, we have to enhance. We can't have a blind spot and say government only controls public housing. Government has to regulate the private rental market to get similar outcomes. Housing quality, housing management on a professional standard, and secure tenancy. And they've eschewed that. They've kept right away from that. And I just put up as a last thing this suggestion to you that perhaps we wouldn't be, in terms of underpinning the importance of grassroots and tenant involved and community controlled models, which won't be big enough to solve the problem, but they could change the dynamic and change the politics. This is a UK viewpoint from last year, which is, and it's been writ large since the terrible, terrible Grenfell fire tragedy. If there was more community control and tenant say and tenant running of decisions around buildings and how they're maintained and so on, would we be in the pickle we're in today? Would government have been able to sell this so short in terms of the provision of public housing? So I'll leave it there.
And I was reading something from Shelter that it's kind of, you know, and there's this implication that if you're in public housing, you need to leave it and become independent. So you must be dependent when you're in public housing, which is an extraordinary claim when you think about the subsidies that homeowners, investors and developers and even private renters through community Commonwealth renter system, a very large untargeted public subsidies. For example, Commonwealth rent assistance is $5 billion a year. Negative gearing and capital gains tax has been estimated at $6 or $7 billion a year. Homeowners, $36 billion a year subsidies through capital gains tax exemption, pension asset tests and land tax exemption. Now, you know, we might all say that's a good thing because it leads to people having homes, but to kind of say that it's only public housing that has subsidies, I think is really, I don't know, it's not, it's talking with a forked tongue, I would say. So I just like to always kind of put that in perspective and also let people that are public housing tenants know that 2015-16 financial year, tenants in public housing tenants in New South Wales, according to FACTS annual report, contributed $826 million. So they are contributing as well. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the government policy framework, and Mike earlier said that, you know, we might have a look inside what government's thinking is, and well, I'd say that's pretty impossible, but we can have a look at some of the things that they housing policy document, and that's on the FACTS website, and also organisations like Shelter and the Tenants Union on their websites will have made submissions to those policy frameworks that were largely ignored. So there's future directions. There's also the Productivity Commission report, or interim report, and that kind of very much dovetails with future directions in lots of ways. And then there's another document by IPART, which is the Independent Pricing and Regulatory Tribunal, and they were asked to do a review of rent models for social and affordable housing. And they say something a little bit different. So that, and again, all those documents are on the web if you really can't sleep at night. Future directions and also the Productivity Commission report, they sort of start out by saying the system's broken, the system's a failure. And I again would disagree with that. I would say actually public housing works really well. It gives people security and it gives people a basis to get on with their lives, to work, go to school, house their families, it's better for their health, all of those sorts of things. The problem is that there's not enough of it. And, you know, there's nothing, and I think Vivian demonstrated that very, very clearly. But that as well is that this more sort of targeting and pushing and things like higher rents for moderate incomes, reviews of tenancies, and in fact they've done the opposite. They create work disincentives as people have to choose between having a job or having a house. They can't kind of have both. And people are rational. You know, that's perfectly normal that you would, you know, want to have a house for your kids. So that hasn't worked. Yet this objective is about encouraging social housing tenants to exit into the private rental market, which is insecure and expensive. So there's probably shelter estimate there's 134,000 deficit of low income rental supply
in New South Wales.
Yes, that's right. The second pillar is a social housing system that is fair, which is
everyone's treated the same.
Yeah, which is kind of bizarre because the whole housing system is unfair, you know, and particularly for low-income households. The current inequality should be addressed by making private rental housing more affordable than secure, not making social housing more conditional and qualified. And it's really quite striking how people that live in public housing are under so much scrutiny and regulation. I don't know any other tenancy where, you know, your neighbour can go to your landlord and complain about you. I mean, does anyone go to the NAB if the person who has a mortgage next to them, you know, they have a problem with their neighbour who has a mortgage with NAB? You know, it's a bizarre kind of situation. But that's not to underestimate, because of the rationing and lack of support, that we're asking tenants in social housing to possibly live in very difficult circumstances and to carry the burden of looking after people in our society that need more support. So in fact, that's not fair. You know, so how you look at fair, it just seems to lead to more and more rationing and regulations, including the recent punitive approach of the three strikes policy, which you can be evicted for. And it also, they've changed the law to make it harder to not evict people for illegal use. And you might say, well, why should people that have, you know, their property is used for illegal use be evicted? Well, because there's circumstances where it's, I like to call it the dickhead boyfriend in the house who's done something, and it's the woman and her kids who gets evicted. So that's the kind of, again, craziness of these punitive approaches. There's also the review of decisions in social housing is a bit strange. You can go to an independent tribunal. Yeah, they've taken out anyone who's able to cross-subsidise, and they say that this means within the existing funding envelope. And I think it might have been Chris Martin who called that a starvation ration, you know. And also, you know, given the fact that in New South Wales, what was the stamp duty windfall? Was it $7 billion or $9 billion? And there's, you know, what is it, $5 or $6 billion surplus that could be used for housing. And we know all the social benefits that flows from that. The Productivity Commission haven't made their final report. That's due in October. It looked at introducing competition and informed user choice into human services. And it's topped the top of its list for services identified as best suited for reform is social housing. So they think it can be, outsourced is a way, and that there should be financial assistance applied across social and private housing. So basically, to me it sounds like a voucher system, but that's probably, maybe drawing a bit of a long bow there. So it would be a single model of financial assistance for...
Would any low-income rental properties now, with landlords knowing that there was a little bit of extra subsidy, actually inflate the costs of renting? There's all those sorts of issues. They do say that they think Commonwealth rent assistance should be increased, saying that it has fallen. And it's surprising the number of renters in New South Wales that have access. It's a huge number, is it? Is it like 70% of people or something in private
they
rental?
They count individuals.
Right.
Because it's a settlement payment, not households.
Uh-huh.
And it's a billion nationally, so it's probably about 35% of that in New South Wales.
Right, yeah.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that there would be an additional payment for tenants who demonstrated need for additional assistance. So you would get a high-cost housing payment, if you're a worker who needed to live in the middle of Sydney or something like that. Now, these are all kind of, this is not what's going to happen. These are ideas floated in an interim report. So this is all about giving opportunity for people to have access to the private rental market. It's interesting, the language, isn't it? It's very ideologically driven. It's a completely different sort of look at it, at the system, and one kind of wonders. Yeah, I just can't sort of see how something like that has any social usefulness or social good in it. The IPART report, on the other hand, gave us all a little bit more hope. It recommended as a principle the importance of affordability of rents, and that social housing rents should continue to be calculated as a percentage of a tenant's income.
Yes.
Because they can't, people can't pay it otherwise. They also found that rent models are not an appropriate tool to create incentives for workforce participation. That's our experience too. If people feel secure, are able to take on some work, which usually when you're first entering the workforce, and particularly if you're entering the community sector workforce, it's temporary and casual work, and so you're not going to give up your house for that. And then gradually over time people move on in the workforce and think makes much more sense to do the carrot rather than the stick. They also acknowledged the terms opportunity and safety net are not helpful. And sorry, this goes back to future directions that the government talk about two groups of people in social housing. Opportunity, which basically means we want to push you out the door, people, and think you can. And safety net, which we think you may need to be in social housing for life. They said that's not helpful. We would agree, because people contribute to their communities in all sorts of ways, not just by working. We know about grandparents looking after grandchildren. We know about volunteer work. We know about the sorts of ways people help each other in this community around here. They also said that financial sustainability is a fundamental objective, and that should be filled by the government. Whoa! So the government actually, fund a service. It notes the current shortfall is $1 billion.
In New South Wales.
Yes, in New South Wales, yep. There's a few things in there that, you know, maybe we would question. Matching households to the best housing for their needs. So this is about requiring tenants to sort of relocate over their life. And my experience is actually that social housing is not very good at organising that. We've had two people contact us this week that wanted to downsize that can't. It's not just like a Tetra kind of thing that, you know, you can move people around, and it gives people again this uncertainty that they're not in control of when and how they move. And my experience is that, you know, there are people that want to downsize, like there are people that want to downsize in private renting.
Whereas communities which have, you know, where disadvantage has been really concentrated because of the way we've selected people to allocate to public housing estates, often don't have that threshold of capacity, and there's often a lot of churn in those communities and so on. So I think the social mix idea in principle works well. That those are still, many of them, relatively low income communities. So there's the differences between people who still own, who own their home, and who are people who from public housing may not be that great. And of course a lot of those communities have also been developed through different waves of immigration and different groups of immigrant people coming together.
And it's been more organic rather than
decided on how they're going to do. And I think that, I've lost my train of thought now, but the same problem applies of government trying to recycle its asset. You know, and public housing generally doesn't sell housing. Community housing providers are more nimble, more active. They can see future needs, and they can sell an asset and renegotiate, and they're more effective at that, I think. So.
And what's your observation?
You know, some co-ops within, or some tenant-managed buildings within, it can all flourish. I mean, public housing's biggest problem is it's always, because it's bureaucratic, it's a one-size-fits-all model. And a one-size-fits-all model isn't responsive or bottom-up or extremely hard for governments to be equal players, not communities or other players.
I nearly get sacked once when I called Tyson bureaucratic.
Few presentations for the entrance.
To the global financial crisis. And the Commonwealth basically paid for the states on their own land or on private land.
Social housing. Where does the affordable housing fit in? Separate to?
Oh yeah, well I didn't want to complicate things tonight.
So the
National Rental Affordability Scheme subsidised private investors to provide housing at least 80% of market rent, but it could be less than that.
And it actually inflated, and then when I give you examples, it inflated the local rentals, so it actually inflated the.
Yeah, but well, let's not go into the flaws with the scheme. It was supposed to provide, it's going to provide 37,000 units across Australia, and that is happening, but they're only for 10 years, and many of them therefore will go to market housing after that when the investor's no longer getting the subsidy. Some of them, about 50%, were done in the not-for-profit sector, because there was capacity there, and they are much more likely to be preserved, and they're often at a lower rent than 80%, 75 or even social housing equivalent rents.
And in some ways, affordable housing is like the old social housing
was. Yes.
It was for families and workers.
Yeah.
I did have a second question
for Amazing. I'll come back to you. No, because I need to get you to keep your spread out.
Quick questions, because if I try for my second one, where, for someone who has not been bought for 40 years when the proto right to buy stuff happened, because of course there's this sort of, we get, in my age group we get taught this story about Australian home ownership that does not include the fact that it was all government built and subsidised, and thus are not told that we should be able to reasonably expect unless we are expecting. We do have very high needs. So in terms of propagating that, where should someone look for a more detailed but still accessible history of that sort of 55 to 72 period?
That's a good question. A story most fully is Pat Troy,
in his book Accommodating Australians, but it's an incredibly difficult to access book. It wouldn't be anyone's bedtime reading. By the way, government didn't only subsidise what I said, they also subsidised mortgage finance for the rest of us that were never in low income or public housing. So when I borrowed to buy my home, the interest rate was capped. And that wasn't borne by the banks, that was borne by the government. It was a regulation. Well, I bought in 1972. And before that, there were terminating building societies and permanent building societies. All of these provided subsidised finance to ordinary Australians to make the market work. Government is everywhere in the housing system. It intervenes everywhere, sometimes effectively and targeted, sometimes not. So, yeah, there's a lot of myths.
My friend from the radio station.
Which were often called arm's length management organisations. And those new entities had to put up a viable plan for renewing their housing using private, have a third residence on their walls. Then there are tenant co-op models in the United States where tenants have taken over whole estates.
What I'm interested in is examples where the human services system has actually changed to support high needs public tenants. One of the issues we have is that because the housing's being rationed, higher needs people are put in without the without that assistance. And one of the arguments we've got for Waterloo is that unless they do something in the human services system, we don't think the system is going to work. And I'm interested to know what models are around in other places that might inform that discussion.
Yeah, not off the top of my head.
Yep.
I couldn't do it. But, I mean, more diverse providers means more specialist providers. Mm.
Yep.
Yeah, who bill purposely for a group, and that's their raison d'etre.
Yep.
So in the UK, you know, you have a big diversity of not-for-profit providers, more diversity than you have here. And I think you will get that here through the NDIS as that takes off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of one example of it. Also, quite often in the UK, housing associations, and in the Netherlands as well, and in America, the community development corporations, they're not just in the business of housing.
Mm.
They're in the business of housing and a whole lot of other human services.
Mm-hmm.
So part of their business model is diversifying and then having the capacity to integrate those services around a client.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't have the silos that we have here of the welfare department, the health department, the housing department. These are local organisations that do these things in an integrated way as a service to their community.
The dangers with those, well, housing becomes dependent on how you participate with those services, which is not, I don't think, what you're talking about, but can be a...
Well, that wouldn't be the philosophy, say, in the Netherlands, because the thinking would be a tenant who doesn't need those services and who's paying their rent is of value to the organisation.
Mm.
And the service would adjust as their needs are changed, or because you know. So it wouldn't be the thinking that one is dependent on the other. I mean, the amazing thing in those organisations is that they value people staying and they plan for their long-term futures. So they plan for when they age, or they plan for the fact that their needs have changed and that they want to respond to that.
The only caution I would add to that discussion is if a community housing provider is the landlord and the support agency, you then run into problems of conflict of interest when there's a problem with the landlord. I mean, most of our clients that seek support is about a problem with Housing New South Wales. If Housing New South Wales was the landlord and the social worker, we would have, you know, a huge conflict. So we need to be careful with the push for that model. You had a question?
Early on in your presentation, I was a bit late, so I might have missed you in explaining it, but you mentioned that it's nearly impossible to know the rate at which governments are demolishing public housing. Could either of you expand on that a little bit?
It's not transparent.
There's a nice piece out of the Auditor General's report that Coutts Trotter himself quoted to Shelter, which said over the last 10 years in New South Wales we have been selling 2.5 houses a day just to keep the system running. The only reason that there was an increase was the stimulus package.
That's right. I mean, South Australia is the worst case. So South Australia, remember I said they were first into the space, they created the housing trust and they had a green economic development and they supported public housing as an economic tool to grow their state. And they ended up with twice the share of public housing in that state than any other state, except ACT, which is a public service town, it's a bit different. So they had 11%, and their auditor came in and said, well, why have you got 11% when everyone else has got 5%? You should sell it down and get rid of it, and they have been. They're down now to about 6%, and they're proud of it. So the lowest common denominator became the benchmark.
Any questions up the back before I go to Janelle for a second question?
10 years ago on this, and we considered it would never be viable to take them down because the densities that were granted were higher than any planning rules now. But I think that's changed. And I think that's probably more likely than not now. And then you've got the issue of what the private sector sees as the image of the area. So when Bonnyrigg went to the market, the private sector was given the option of only part demolishing, and they wanted a clean field. You know, so if they can make it work by arguing the densities up and arguing for other concessions and pushing back on the social outcomes, they'll get their way. I mean, they're very, very powerful.
So that, I guess, then is the work that the community are doing here in saying and having a different vision and putting forward a different perspective. But yes, you're right, it's about power, isn't it?
So the official answer is there is no decisions about the high-rise. They're about to commence a master planning process where the community will be consulted about what the future of Waterloo will look like. They say it's a blank canvas, it's all open for debate, etc., etc. However, political drive and economic drive would probably indicate that those high-rises will eventually come down because the need for housing stock and money and sell off. The only thing that I could see that saving those high-rises is a different government and a different policy, but I can't really see that happening. But it's a lot, I think, my best guess, and that's all it is, and my best guess, the high rises would be the last to be affected in the redevelopment because it's the biggest bulk of people. But that is just my guess.
So why are they renovating the lifts then if they're earmarked for demolition?
Because the argument is it's a... Yeah, it's a 20...
they're a landlord and they have responsibilities. One
was home. So it's about a 20-year process. The planning alone will take 2 years, so I don't think...
Well, the other thing is, if it's 10 years, it's incredibly market contingent.
Yes,
that's right.
Yeah. We've had an amazing cycle of upmarket, but what if we have a down market? And that's the biggest risk, that it's partially done.
People were out elsewhere. The IT boards, Germany.